to everyone. We'll start the class momentarily. Hope you all had a good week. And again, we just ask that once you see the, once you hear the audio stream, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen to give us confirmation that you picked up the stream properly. And we'll just start the class momentarily today. Today we'll be discussing sin, the loss of sin. We'll pause during the class. So this way, if you have any comments, you can type them in. And if there's any point, or if you join late, we do put the class online, usually about a half an hour or an hour or so after the class concludes. So this way, you can hear the class in its entirety. And that's posted underneath the audio and also the talk, the new postings links. Yes, hello.
Good morning, Rabbi.
How you doing, Doug? How you doing, Cal? How are you?
I'm fine.
Much so.
What's that?
And we got Sean and Bill with us.
Okay, hey, Sean and Bill, how are you today?
Good, thank you.
And I realized at the end of the last week's session that we didn't really bring it back to the original question, so I'll just conclude it now. If you remember, we were talking about, you know, the sacrifice of Isaac, and the fact that the Rashi that we saw in the Parsha of Emor, that refers to Rosh Hashanah as a day of remembrance of the Trua. So we want to understand what the reasoning is that Rosh Hashanah is referred to as a day of remembrance of the Trua. The Trua means the shofar blast. So Rashi says that the verses of God's, the fact that God is omniscient, and also verses referring to the shofar blasts, should be recalled on that day. So God will remember the sacrifice of Isaac, which Abraham replaced with the ram. Right? That's what he said was very significant. That really would seem to be the sacrifice of Isaac itself should, obscure any other element of that event, because that was where he was really sacrificing his own child. But Rashi points to the idea that it was the sacrifice of Isaac that Abraham had replaced with Isaac, the ram that he found caught in the thicket. So that was, we felt, was significant. And what we said is that it demonstrated, I was quoting Shai Aman, who gave this answer, that it shows that even though a normal person would recoil at that point, now that he was told, don't kill Isaac, now I see that you're about to do it, you've demonstrated your perfection, there's no need to kill Isaac. So a normal person would just be completely, you know, overwhelmed and happy with the fact that he now has a son back. But Abraham was not that way. Abraham was not more interested in the son than he was in terms of his attachment to God. That was something which just overwhelmed Abraham more, which shows you another point that the intelligence of a person can override the emotional part of man. And that's why it is just that if a person sins, he's punished, and which we'll get into today, into the whole topic of sin. But the fact that God created us with the ability to do good has to be something which is a stronger pull than instincts. Because if our instincts were stronger than intelligence, it would be unjust for God to tell us to, you know, follow the intelligence. That's only if the instincts are more powerful, so it would not be fair. It's like telling a child to lift up a ton of weights. It's a possibility. But we see from Abraham that he's a human being just like we are. There is no difference in the design between him and us. And therefore, he represents the actual human design. And if he can reach this level, that means it is something which is within reach for mankind. And what we're doing now on Rosh Hashanah is we're asking God to recall that this is human nature, and look what he was able to do. He was able to demonstrate his love for you more than man, meaning he was able to reach that pinnacle of perfection, and let this concept of man's capacity come before you today and recall that event of Abraham. Therefore, you should inscribe the whole world for good based on the fact that Abraham demonstrated this level of perfection that we can't all reach. So since this is within our reach, even though we're not there now, we want to recall this today in Rosh Hashanah when God is inscribing everybody for the next year. So this is just the point that really ties up what we discussed last week, why it is that this is something which is relevant to Rosh Hashanah, because Rosh Hashanah is when God is inscribing everybody, so to speak, for the coming year. And what we want to ask God to do is please to be generous and merciful and look at the capacity that we have, and based on what we can achieve, let that be the reason why you would inscribe us for good. Okay. Is it clear?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I realized after we got off the phone that we didn't answer the original question. So I'm glad I recalled that, and I just made a note to do that today. All right. How's the sound, by the way? Is this the sound that's picking up all right today on the phone?
That sounds good, thank you.
Okay. Now, today, just wanted to touch on something which is important. Sometimes I realize we haven't really covered something which I feel is fundamental that we should. There's a lot of things we have to keep in mind, but we shouldn't let the fact that there's so much out there deter us from, just going into different areas, even if it's, a whole new topic for the next week. But this concept of sin just struck me lately as being something which is really important that we have an appreciation for what it does to us, and to approach it intelligently, but to also recognize the gravity. So when we talk about sin, so let's just define our terms again. That's always the most important thing. So sin is typically understood as when a person goes against a command in the Torah. And of course, there's different degrees of severity. A person steals a penny, or a person, steals $1 million. He's hurting a person in two, qualitatively different ways. Or you can compare stealing to idolatry. So, idolatry is much worse, of course, because a person's corrupting a much graver aspect of his life, of his whole existence. And the reason we got on this is because I was reviewing a segment in Talmud Horios, and a statement came up that all the Torah is equated to idolatry. And a second statement is, I believe it was Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi who made the statement. So he says that all the Torah is equated to idolatry. And he says another statement that all mitzvos, every mitzvah, all of them, are weighed against idolatry. So what does that mean? All mitzvos are weighed against idolatry. How would you understand that?
That would be, I mean, the sin of idolatry is kind of the measuring stick, and so when you look at severity, everything is looked at as how severe it is in relation to idolatry, which is considered the worst.
So you're saying that each command is compared to idolatry?
Right.
What does that mean? I'm not sure I follow. How is by not wearing tzitzis compared to idolatry?
To me, it would be like if you have a star basketball player who can score 30 points in a game, every other basketball player is measured against that. So if someone scores 20 points in a game, you know, in rough numbers, they're considered two-thirds as good as that one player. In this case, if idolatry is considered the ultimate sin, then the severity of the failure to keep any other commandment is measured against that one. So, for example, stealing would, as you pointed out, would be considered less severe.
I hear you.
How that measurement is actually done, I couldn't say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hear what you're saying. It's interesting. I didn't think of that angle. The Maimonides says that, and he refers to this Talmudic section, he says that if a person commits idolatry, it's like he denied the entire Torah, and if he denies idolatry, it's like he kept the entire Torah. So let's ask the question again with that additional clarification. And let me ask it again. So what is meant that if you deny idolatry, it's like you kept the whole Torah, and if you accept idolatry, so it's like you denied the whole Torah. How do we understand that?
Well, if we hypothesize that committing idolatry moves you severely out of the world of reality and away from Hashem, then keeping that, fulfilling, I guess, the command to deny idolatry or to stay away from it, moves you into that world. So you are, in a sense, fulfilling the purpose of the Torah. The purpose of the Torah is to bring you into reality in the world of true ideas.
So what does it mean that it's like I deny the whole Torah if I do that one sin of idolatry? I'm the same. I'm a good Jew. I'm keeping, you know, all the commands, right? Or I'm a, you know, a perfected Ben Noach. I'm keeping all my commands. And now both that Jew and that Ben Noach decide they're going to serve an idol one day. So what is Maimonides' statement saying that if you accept idolatry, it's like you're denying the entire Torah? I mean, what about all those commands that I did my whole life?
Well, but they would essentially be of no effect because theoretically the purpose of those is to bring you into alignment with the truth, and if you're going to just on a wholesale way deny the truth by accepting idolatry, you might as well, they don't do anything for you.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what he means, right. That you can keep the entire Torah system. And there's actually a question that was asked to a great rabbi. I'm not sure if it was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, blessed memory, or another great rabbi. But they asked the question, let's say a person keeps the entire Torah system, but he thinks that God is an old man in the sky with a long gray beard. So the rabbi responded, he says, it's a grave, unfortunate thing, but he has no share in the next world. Which means what you just said, that there is absolutely no value whatsoever to every other mitzvah he did, because every other mitzvah in the Torah targets some greater acknowledgement of God. And that's what I believe the statement is that each one of the commands are weighed against idolatry means that just taking your example with the basketball player a little bit further, that each one of the commands has to cause a person to bring himself to a greater understanding of God. And if it is not achieving that, meaning to say, if you are keeping all the commands, but you think God is human or some other anthropomorphic ideal that you accept as a reality, so then everything that you did is worthless, because your idea of tefillin or tzitzis or the holidays or Shabbos, all these ideas that you believe that these mitzvahs that you're fulfilling, you have a concept that these were all commanded by some physical object in the sky. So then your idea about all these commands are completely nullified. They're completely null and void, like you said. So that's why if a person commits idolatry, it's as if he denied the entire Torah. It means that he can keep everything in the Torah, but if his idea of God is incorrect, so it's worthless. He's not realizing God in any of the other commands, because he has a completely wrong idea of God. Which means to say that when we keep any command, we should try to see how it actually gives us a better understanding or another facet of our appreciation of what God is. Whether it's part of his kindness or his justice or aspects of his creation. Each one should really be moving us towards that. And like Rashi says, Rabbi Che, I'm just quoting him, he says there's a Rashi in Deuteronomy that states if a person does a command but he has no idea why he's doing it, meaning he doesn't understand the intellectual component of the command, then it is useless. So that really corroborates what we're saying.
So, Rabbi, I want to ask a question.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Then, with that in mind, then, it's one of the fundamentals would be, before one should even try to keep mitzvahs, is that he has clear in his own mind exactly what the nature of God is, so that if he can get that firmly rooted in himself and he uses that as a standard, then he's more prepared to be able to keep the mitzvahs, because he's got a measuring, something to measure against whether or not he's delving or moving off into an area he shouldn't be involved in. So if you try to keep mitzvahs and you're not clear, at least philosophically or in terms of reality, as to the nature of God, to guard yourself against that idolatry, then you really have things kind of backwards, correct?
That's right. That's right. That really has to be the fundamental. I mean, it's not only historically true, but the Torah opens up with God being the creator, because that's the most primary knowledge we have to have, right? As soon as we open up the Torah, boom, it's right there.
Rabbi?
Yes.
But a couple of thoughts. One is, I thought at the beginning that the Jewish people said, we will do and we will understand, putting the doing first before the understanding. In other words, they would accept the Torah and then they would understand it. And the other question is, well, it's also my understanding that King Solomon figured out the reasons behind all the commandments except one, which is the ashes of the red heifer. So, doesn't that suggest that at least initially one is commanded to do even before you understand, but perhaps then you have an obligation to try to delve out the reason?
Well, I mean, the Jews were not operating in a vacuum when they said we will do and we will understand. This is subsequent to Egypt and to the realization of what God means. So that's just in terms of when they said do it on the stand, it wasn't just without any concept at all of what God is yet. So it was qualified. Now that they had a concept, they knew what God is, they said that's why we're going to do it on the stand, because we know he's the creator. Otherwise, it's just like, following Jesus. You have to be following it based on what you've seen already as being true.
Well, Rabbi, isn't it one of the classic debates? I don't know if it's in the Gemara about, you know, what should come first. Doing, should a person understand the meaning behind the mitzvah before he does it versus actually beginning to do it, and then as he does it, he grows in his understanding of the mitzvah. Isn't there, don't the mafarshim or the...
I have a hard time hearing you. Can you speak a little louder?
I'm sorry. I've got my wife here as well, and she's trying to listen, so I have it on speakerphone. But how's that? Is that okay?
Yeah, much better. Thank you.
Okay. Well, the question I have is: isn't there a fairly large debate in the Gemara someplace or in Jewish philosophy that they discuss what should come first, the doing or the understanding versus the understanding and the doing? Aren't there a lot of rabbis in the past that have gotten into the debates as to exactly how it works that a person, it's like a child. Sometimes you have a child and you're trying to teach them to do the right thing, but, you know, you get them used to the idea, you get them into the routine of actually doing what you're expecting them to do, you're asking them to do it, they go through the motions of actually doing it, and then later on they come to an understanding and appreciation of the importance of why they were doing it, as opposed to initially understanding it clearly. You know, if my child came to me and says, "Well, Dad, I'm not going to do what you want me to do until I personally understand what it is you want me to do." In other words, until it's clear in my own mind, I don't feel any obligation to obey you. So
the obligation of course is there. So that's something which we have to do, but we have to clarify that we're talking about two different events. The first question was what Doug was mentioning about at Sinai, where they said everything God says we will do and then we will understand. And then we have today. So we have to be clear on is there a distinction. Now, of course, today we have an obligation, you know, both Noahide and Israelite in terms of the Torah, and that is not dependent upon our knowledge, because we can't make our comprehension the determinant in terms of following the laws. I mean, once we have a concept of what God is, because you can't start talking to a person who doesn't know anything about God and give them a book and say you got to follow X, Y, and Z and expect them to follow it. That's just not a rational expectancy. I mean, if it would be that there was a person alive today that never heard of God, and we approach him with this book, and we can trace back his roots to being a Jew, but he never heard of God before. He was raised on an island, whatever the case is. So it's like somebody coming to us today and saying, "Here's a book, you got to follow everything in this book." We're going to look at this guy like, you know, as a fool. What do you expect? Are you expecting me just to stop my whole life and follow a whole different lifestyle because you are giving me a book? No, that's not rational. But if a person is proven to him that God exists and that God is the source of all the commands, now, just because I don't understand them does not mean I should deny what I already know, that God is the author of this book, and he's the creator, and he knows what's best. So that would be intelligently wrong for an individual to do. That's what the Jew says. Everything God says we will do, and then we will understand. We need to say we trust completely that these things must be right and absolutely demanded to be followed by man, because man is a creation of this God. Now, once I have that, then it's foolish. It's like going to a doctor who says you're going to die unless you take this medication. And I say, no, I'm going to read about the medication first, and then I'll take it. Meanwhile, I can die. But if I already accepted that this doctor knows exactly what he's doing, then it's foolish for me to put my knowledge in front of his. So that's one thing. That's where we're at today. All right, and the Jews back then, that's referring to the Jews back then, that they had that knowledge already. But a person today would be correct in saying, "Listen, I don't know anything about you talking about. Prove to me that he is right to ask. Prove to me that this book you're giving me is really this thing called God. Prove to me this God is true." Now, once that would be the first step intelligently. I can't see a human being doing anything otherwise than that.
Rabbi, just another question, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
My my wife has asked a question. She's written it on a page, and I'm just going to, in order for it to be more clear, I'm just going to read it. But she asked the question concerning the, like, hukim, you know, the hukim portion of the commandments dealing with, I mean, sure, you know what I'm talking about, kosher, that sort of thing.
Right.
The commandments, you know, versus, you know, mishpatim, and the idea of hukim, those don't, quote-unquote, have any rational explanation behind why you do them. It's just that they are done anyway. Now, I know I've read someplace, I don't know if it's Rashi, but he actually does give rational explanation for the hukim. But generally, they're understood as that they have no logical reason behind them, although we know there's logic, they're done anyway. So, I mean, in that sense, a person is keeping mitzvahs without really fully understanding what the purpose is, correct?
Well, I mean, I don't agree with that definition of hukim.
It's weak in my part. I apologize.
Yeah, I mean, hukim, I believe Rabbi Chait once said that it is something which you can't pinpoint what the reason is. But for sure, if hukim are things which the intelligent God gave man, then they have to be based in intelligence. Everything which emanates from God is beautifully sound in his reasoning, and it's just our ignorance. For example, the difference between hukim and mishpatim would be the difference between not mixing wool and linen and not killing. So not killing, I understand, just from sensibility, that the society is not going to exist if, you know, killing is rampant. So that's an intellectual. That is something which is called a mitzvah that is reasoned from the intelligence. That is not something which is authoritative in character. So I don't need an authority to tell me not to kill or not to steal or not to rape. These are things all called mitzvos sichlios, mitzvos that stem from our seichel, from our intelligence. Then there are mitzvos which benefit us, but we would not have come up with them on our own. Nobody would ever come up with the idea of putting black boxes on their head or on their bicep across from the heart. Nobody would come up with the idea of strings dangling from four corners of your garment. This does not mean, however, that those hukim are bereft of any reason. It just means that the concept itself is more authoritative than something you would arrive at on your own, but the person can look into the hukim as well and see what the perfections are that we gain from them. So I don't agree that, you know, and like you said, you know, Rashi will start explaining. And Ibn Ezra, I mean, the rabbis all explain the different chukim. Ibn Ezra talks about that the not mixing wool and linen is to recall two elements that you have in your heart, that are planted in your heart, and you shouldn't mix them, meaning instincts and emotions. So Rabbi Chaita gave a beautiful class on that. That by separating wool from linen in our garments, we're reminded to separate something else. And it's not just in our clothing. We're not allowed to work two diverse species of animals together. You know, lest they copulate and have offspring that are mixed. We can't plant two diverse species in the ground that are too close, that their roots might intermingle, and then they will also produce. So there's many areas that this law extends itself to, but it calls back, according to Ibn Ezra, to the idea of having a certain separate or division that we're conscious of in our, you know, daily activities. And why is it wool and linen? Well, if you think about it, wool is from the animal world, right? It's from an animal. And linen is from flax, from vegetation. And aside from animal and vegetation, there exists nothing that you can't have the concept of crossbreeding. So, in the very mixture of wool and linen in the clothing, it points to the two very categories in which crossbreeding can exist. In terms of iron or rocks, there's no such concept as crossbreeding because there's no such thing as growth. So, since growth only exists in the animal world and in the plant world, so those are the only two areas, and that's why understanding is why wool and linen are selected as objects. It could have been something else, maybe not wool, or maybe wool and cotton, but God's wisdom dictated that these would be in this, you know, there should be reason for this as well. You know, Maimonides also says, though, however, that sometimes you just have a law because there has to be some object. For example, the number of sacrifices. If the number of sacrifices is 7, so you can ask, well, why did there have to be 7? Why couldn't it be 6? So Maimonides says, well, if it was 6, you'd ask the same thing. Well, why isn't it 7? So sometimes you just have to have something. And then there's no real, you know, any other reason except for the need for the command, and there has to be number. So, you know, it's just, you know, it's necessary. But in terms of each individual command, there is, you know, beautiful ideas behind them all, and the fact that, like Doug said, that, well, I'm not sure who said it, but that King Solomon knew the reasons for all the laws, except for the ashes of the red heifer. So that means all the other statutes, all the other chukim, he did understand, right? So that's a clear proof that there is understanding to the other ones.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. So now we understand what it means now when Maimonides, you know, quoting the Talmud, that the commitment of idolatry is like a denial of all the Torah, because since every single one of the commands is really to give us another appreciation. Like, for example, we're talking about shatnez. We're talking about where you're not allowed to mix wool and linen. So we now understand how this, let's just take it, you know, full circle. How does shatnez, the prohibition to mix species in both our clothing and working animals together or planting mixed species, how does this give us a greater appreciation of God? So let's take it step by step. So I don't mix the species because I'm supposed to, according to Ibn Ezra, keep a division between my intelligence and my emotions. So now my intelligence is going to be pure. It'll allow me to have a greater understanding in other areas, because since my intelligence is not diluted anymore, so now when I approach all other areas in life, it is going to allow me to have a greater understanding of God. So we see right there how the separation of the species is to target greater understanding of God. We take, for example, the lulav and the esrog that we shake on the holiday of Sukkos. So the Gemara talks about why we're waving it forward and back and left and right, and also why we're waving it up and down. So we wave it forward, back, left, and right, because these are the directions on Earth. These are, you know, map coordinates. Everything is always oriented to north, south, east, and west. That's in terms of man's activity on Earth. We live in a horizontal plane, right? The Earth is flat, and all of our movement on the Earth is, you know, predominantly horizontal. We go forward, we go back, left and right. So all activities of man on Earth can be said to be forward, backwards, left and right. Correct? Now, that being the case, when we wave these plants forward, back, left and right, so we're now taking that which God created, and we're saying that God is aware of all of man's actions. And he is the one that really will determine our successes in life. That's why we're praying in Rosh Hashanah to have, you know, a good year. But not only do we wave things forward, back, left, and right, that's in terms of man's realm, but we wave the esrog and the lulav up and down. And this is to show that, as the Talmud continues, that we recognize God who created what is up and what is down, meaning the heavens and the earth. So that means in terms of creation. So we pinpoint the concept of creation by moving the lulav and esrog up and down. We're pointing upwards and we're pointing downwards. We're saying that everything up is due to God and everything down is due to God. That means creation. But in terms of moving the esrog north, south, east, and west, meaning all of man's directions, so that now means that God's government of man is something which is, we recognize that he has complete control. So it's two main categories again. Government of what God created, and also the fact that he created it. So we look at God in the capacity of creator. When we move the esrog up and down, up is everything he created in the heavens, and down is below. That means everything in existence, whatever is above and whatever is below, it is due to God. So that means God in terms of creator. But God didn't just create the universe and leave it. No, he governs it, and he is very much involved. And we see through all the miracles that proves that he's involved in human life. So that's the second point of moving the esrog forward, back, and left, and right. So we're targeting two main fundamentals again. And now this gives us a greater appreciation yearly of these two capacities. All right? So it's the second example of how a mitzvah, a command, is giving us appreciation of God. Okay, so far?
Yes.
All right, so now we see that if we keep idolatry, if this is something which we live by, so all of these commands that we're doing are useless. They're worthless because we have a wrong concept of what God is. So all these are the commands that are targeting the knowledge of God to some measure. Have completely, they're all just inadequate. They have not reached the mark at all. So they're useless. And it was interesting that I just noted a distinction, like between, if we take something like a human mechanism, like a watch, and we compare it to the Torah. So we have two systems. We have a timepiece, and then we have the Torah. So in a timepiece, there's an objective of the timepiece, and that is to tell time, of course. But if you would take any one of the components, the gears, the springs, the arms, any individual thing, and ask, well, what is the function of the gear? Well, the gear's function is merely to spin. And then it's to turn another gear. And that other gear is to turn. And then you have a spring, which is to release energy. So we wind up the spring, it now has potential energy, and then as it's unwinding, it's got kinetic energy, and it's now causing things to move. So each individual component does not have the same objective as the entire timepiece. Meaning, if a gear was able to tell time, you wouldn't need the rest of the watch. You'd just have a gear strapped to your wrist. But it doesn't work that way in physics, in physical laws, in terms of what man makes. Each individual element has its own function, and when they work together, then they can achieve the real optimum, and that is to tell time. But in the Torah system, it's not that way. Even the individual 613, every single one of the 613 commands themselves has the same goal as the entire system. And it's actually a statement that King Solomon said. He said that a single mitzvah is equated to a single flame, but the whole Torah is equated to light. Right? That's a very interesting statement. Ki ner mitzvah v'Torah or. For a flame is a single mitzvah, but the Torah, that is light. So what he's saying is that even a single mitzvah has some quality of illumination, albeit just a single flame. But it has the same quality as the entire Torah, which is to give light. But you see, it's a flame. It still is qualitatively different, because the single mitzvah is talked about as just being a flame. He doesn't talk about it as in the language of light. The Torah, he says, Torah is light, meaning now you have something which illuminates you in your life and shows you the right path. So a single mitzvah has the ability to give off light, but he doesn't call it that because it still is inadequate. The single mitzvah itself is inadequate. That's why there's an entire system. You need the entire system in order to actually see the whole picture. And it does take years until a person is investigating and now comes to a higher plateau and he sees new levels he reaches in life as he's embracing more and more understandings of each individual mitzvah. Now he starts seeing a bigger picture as he grows. So, but the point is that even in the Torah, see, the Torah is a system of revealed knowledge. So since it's a system of knowledge, that means every single aspect of that must uncover some knowledge. So that means every element is going to give you some knowledge, even though it's not as much as the entire picture, even though it's not as much as the whole 613. So this really supports what we're saying, that if a person's got a wrong concept of God, so now he tries to do a mitzvah, an individual mitzvah, of lighting a Shabbos candle or whatever it is. So now he's not going to be achieving anything, because since every individual mitzvah has to give some element of understanding to the human being, if his concept of God is wrong, so that element of understanding of God is completely missed. Now, what does this all have to do with sin? So when a person sins, The reason why he's able to do that is because, first of all, his emotions get the hold of him. And Sforno talks about this in the beginning of Genesis, and he says that when God says to the snake, he says that man will step on your head and crush you, but you will bite man in the heel, and you'll succeed. So he shows the two possible outcomes of the interplay between man and the snake. If man steps on the snake's head, he'll kill the snake. If he doesn't, and the snake will bite man in the heel, so then man loses. But on a metaphoric level, this also, I think, clearly depicts the battle between man and his instincts. If when the instincts approach you, and the instincts being metaphorically meaning the snake here, if when the instincts first approach you, and if there's a certain pull on you to do something instinctually, so if you attack it right away at the head of the battle, then you'll win. If you don't let the emotions swell inside of you and get the upper hand, you can still beat out the instincts whenever you have a pull to do something. However, if you don't fight the instincts right away and you let them swell inside of you, so at the heel of the battle, meaning at the end, the instincts are going to win because that's how they work. You have to combat the instincts as soon as you sense them. That's the head of the battle. So it's like saying if you step on that snake's head, man will win. But if you don't, so the snake will bite man in the heel. Man, snake will get man at the end, at the heel of the battle. So, just in terms of being on guard, whenever we sense something as being, a problem arising, certain emotions, we have to recognize it right away and remove ourselves from it, change our thoughts, whatever the tactic is that we can employ, we should do. And that will now change us from that mood, from that emotional grip that the instincts are trying to throw upon us, and we won't be cast into the net of the instincts. But if we do, and we sin, so how do we get to that point of sin? Because we know that something is wrong to do, so how can we finally sin? So, of course, we're familiar with the phenomenon of rationalizing. And this is what a man will do. He'll have a pull emotionally. He knows it's wrong, but if he lets the emotions swell inside of him, he'll find rationalizations, all right, this is the last time I'll steal, or whatever it is, and it overcomes him, and he justifies it. And this is really where the real corruption of sin is, the real loss, because here is where man's intelligence is now being corrupted. He's now letting himself think somehow that there is a good in sin, because there is an underlying principle as to what is good for me, and I cannot do anything which goes against what I feel is good for me. Even when I steal, I have to somehow rationalize it and say, well, there is a good reason why I can't do this right now. A person can't, by nature. A person cannot do something which is he really feels is going to harm him. He has to rationalize it. This is something Rabbi Chait had in my early years. I remember that being a very impressive concept. And just hearing that and thinking that, it gives you insight into why there's this whole need to rationalize, because a person wants to satisfy emotional gratifications. That's really what we're used to from our youth. And the way we could do it, even when we're older, is if we employ this rationalization. But what that does, we have to realize, the real loss of sin is that we're now teaching ourselves that there is something good in going against what God says for us. That's just like not listening to a doctor. So here is really where the worst harm is done in terms of sin. It now causes man to orient themselves towards thinking that there's some good in hurting himself. He justifies it. He rationalizes it. And this is really, if he does it enough, like the rabbis say, the person does a sin once or twice, it now becomes like a mitzvah. It becomes like it's permitted. It becomes like a permitted thing because he's done it so much, it's like a light thing already, and he's rationalized it, and his whole thinking has been corrupted. And he's moving away from the entire goal that we have in life is to understand what's true, not to deny what's true, and to change that in our mind. So this is really where it is. And again, this will lead us to having like the what we learned in the Parsha yesterday, the great punishments that God will give the Jews if they do sin. And, tremendous devastation, and to the point where we'll be besieged by enemies, and there'll be no food, and mothers will cook their children and eat them. I mean, it gets to such horrific levels. But the reason why is because this will support the Torah's truth. That when God says these things are going to happen and they finally do happen, it endorses the Torah as being true. It shows that God says, you see, I told you this is what's going to happen if you don't follow the Torah system. And it does happen, so it now is evidence to the fact that God will bring these curses. But it all along, it shows when the great good happens to the Jew or the great evil happens to the Jew, all along, it's the same goal of portraying the Torah as being true. So that's an important understanding as to why it can be so devastating. And of course, we have to realize that, you know, sin as well, it could forfeit a good life here, as well as removing us from an eternal life in Olam Haba, the next world. I mean, this is a temporary life, and we have to recognize that. We can't live with such morbidity on a regular daily basis, but, you know, one eye should be open to that reality, that this is temporary, and the rabbis do speak about this and say that this world is just a vestibule to the main banquet hall. So we're here a few decades, and that is it. So we should, you know, seek eternal life and not try to harm what, you know, our portion in the next world. So this is also something which is, I guess, you know, we're living in a physical, sensual world. It's difficult to divorce ourselves from all these sensations and just, like, I even hear friends of mine say, I just can't imagine anything but this world. And it's true, it is overwhelming because this is all we know. But just because this is the only world we know does not mean this is the only world. And it's something which I think takes more than just one time, you know, of discussing it to really, you know, hit ourselves in our conviction and to really, you know, hit the core and that we really live that way. But these are things that should be before our mind's eye. That since our goal is to see truth, and that's why we have intelligence and no other creature has it, so when we sin and we distort what we know is true, we're moving away from our one chance at life. And it should be a very, we should view it very tragically, and we should have great remorse. I mean, King David talked about that. Even after he repented from sins, he said, but my sins are always before me. Meaning there's no, my friend Yossi Azos had given a little speech at, I think, the bris of one of his sons. And he said, he was quoting this, and what he was explaining King David is saying is that, it's true I can repent, but the time that I sin, that is irreplaceable. You cannot turn back the hands of time. That was time that could have been well spent gaining in terms of understanding of God as opposed to sinning and going backwards. All right. All right, let me pause here. Let's see if there's any comments or questions.
Hello?
Yes, Cal.
Sounded a little, well, throughout this, that there was an exchange of the term instincts and emotion as if they were synonymous. Do you make a distinction between them, or do you use them interchangeably?
Interchangeably, yes. They're the same thing to me. Unless you have a distinction that you want to tell me that you're thinking.
I can't think of any, but I just was wondering if they are considered pretty much the same thing.
All right, I use them interchangeably.
I guess the reason I ask the question is because I look at, when you think of the animals and everything, they operate off of their basic instincts, and that's sort of our basic, what our instincts are, what propel us to survive in a sense. And so if we need those for survival, they're necessary. And I guess it's important that then as man, the intellect overrules the instincts, but they're still necessary.
Yes, I mean, there's two things you're saying. Your one thing is whether or not the instincts and the emotions are the same. And the other thing you're saying is that the instincts are necessary in man. So in terms of whether they are the same, you could say, I use instinct and emotions in the same sense. But yeah, of course, they are necessary.
Okay.
So hopefully this, you know, this little discussion on sin, because sometimes it's more of a infantile view that we have about the sin. You did something bad, and God's going to get you. I think we have to, as we grow, we always have to, you know, reevaluate our assessments that many times are just carryovers from our youth, and look at it again. What exactly do we mean by sin, and what is the loss of it? And if we appreciate it and make, you know, and we mature our ideas, then it'll have more meaning to us, and it won't have this, you know, infantile, you know, irrelevant type of a feeling. But we can now have an intellectual appreciation as to what exactly the sin is, and it helps us in staying away from it, because now, as an adult, and as we're valuing more and more about having a Torah lifestyle, then when we see something that we identify as really removing us from that clearly, now we will, it'll give us more energy to and more conviction not to give in to the sin the next time, because now we understand how harmful it can really be. All right.
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
Does this then suggest, I mean, the Noahides have seven categories of commandments, which if you equate them out to the specifics of the 613, I think the number comes out to be in the high 60s, significantly less than the Jewish people have.
Right.
Presumably, God gave... if I ignore the ones that Noahides are not allowed to keep, like Shabbos and such, God gave those commandments to the Jewish people for their good and their perfection. Does that suggest then that if a Noahide doesn't choose to take on all of those commandments, that that's a character flaw in not recognizing the real good, so to speak?
Yeah, I would say so. Meaning that there is a minimum that is obligatory, but again, that's just to be a starting point. I mean, we have the Medrash of the rabbis that God offered the Torah to all the nations, but for one reason or other, they rejected it, which means that the Torah is fit to be followed by other people, but because of their idiosyncratic emotions, they rejected it, but it really was presented to them. So today as well, if a person recognizes a person's Noahide and he sees a command, that's not one of his the ones that he's obligated to do, but he sees the truth in it, so I would definitely say it would be just like if a Jew would scoff at one of the mitzvahs that he has to do, because there's a gain there that he can't achieve, and he's not going to be gaining that perfection if he doesn't do it. So just like the Jew is not gaining, so the Jew and Noahide, no different in terms of design. It's merely, you know, a role designation, that's all. So there has to be a lack of gain. However, with the Jew, there's a sin. He's going against God's will in that case, whereas the Noahide is not. So there is a big difference in that respect. There is no sin on the Noahide not to do it. But the fact that he's not involved in a certain activity that gives certain truths, you can't say that he has the benefit if he's not doing it. I mean, if I'm not drinking water, I'm not going to quench my thirst. So the same thing here.
Okay, but it's also, I've never gotten the impression that the ultimate end goal of the Torah is that the entire world converts to become Jewish.
No, but it's funny. I mean, Isaiah does talk about it in the beginning, and he says that the other nations will stream to Israel to learn Torah. I mean, let's see. One second. I mean, he talks about them bringing sacrifices and... yeah, let's see what it says here. Yeah, it says in Isaiah 2:2. It says in the end of days, God's mountain will be established at the top of all mountains, and all nations will stream there to him. And many people will go there, and they will say, and this is now 2:3, they will say, let us go up to God's mountain, to the house of God, of Jacob, and they will teach us of his ways, and we will go in his paths. Because from Zion, from Jerusalem, comes forth Torah, and the word of God from Jerusalem. Right. So it talks about Torah as being the system. But again, I mean, just intelligently, I don't see how a person can gain if he's not doing something. So you can't compare a Noachide that's keeping 7 laws to a Noachide that's keeping 60. Or to a Noachide keeping 60 to a Noachide that's observing 260. Of course, I mean, the one who's involved in more is going to be gaining greater. But again, you see that this was how it was before the Torah. God did not have a system that he gave to man. There was 1 or 7 mitzvahs, depending on the point in time, but that was it. So God's initial plan was that man would have his intelligence, and he'd be following the intelligence that he had. Right? The Talmud says that Adam only had 1 command, or 3 commands, and that were derivatives. And then Noah had 7. So why was it so few? Evidently, God's plan was initially that a person would be following what his mind tells him, and not from a system. But after time unfolded, and so many corruptions had entered the world stage, so that it was necessary that this system was given that combated all the ways of the Canaanites and the Egyptians. And you see how much the Torah is addressing those mistakes. So it's a response to a corruption. Again, we can't say that God never was going to give this Torah and he didn't know about it at the beginning. Of course he knew. So, when was God, what was God's plan, so on and so forth, we can't say for sure. But I think it's a very safe statement that whoever's involved more in seeing God's truth is gaining more. And, to the point that a person who converts to Judaism, he is equal, completely. Numerous times the Torah says that. But it doesn't say he's equal when he's not converted. So that means to say that there is a, that equality he's talking over there is that he has obligation. And he has to have the same exact system that the Jew has. But the truth is, you could also give an argument. There's a Noahide that has, he's keeping 50 laws, 40 laws, whatever it is, but he's keeping them completely, understanding them perfectly, and it's consuming all his time. You have to say he's reached a very high level of perfection as compared to a Jew who begrudgingly does 613. If you were spending, the real, what it really boils down to is that if a person is really dedicated to his studies and is doing what he can, he has to earn a living too. But if he's really living that way, that's basically Avraham Avinu. That's like the most perfected person. So you can't say it's really the number of mitzvahs, because it could just be a time factor. There's a time factor in terms of, the Talmud even says, it doesn't matter whether a person learned a lot or he learned a little, provided that when he was learning, he was doing it for the proper reasons. He was purely interested in seeing truth and applying it to himself. So we have to realize that you can't say that Ben Noach is going to be penalized and it's going to be any less perfected than a Jew if the Ben Noach is, let's say, keeping 30. And that just takes up all this time and he's studying through and there's, God's wisdom is infinite. So he could spend his whole life. There were rabbis that spent their whole lives in only 1 tractate of the 60 tractates of the Talmud. So they were doing 1/60th of what everybody else was covering. But if they got so into and they saw the perfection of a certain area and they were immersed in it and they were doing what they're supposed to do, and their studies just kept them circling on 1 Talmudic tractate. And you can't say that they've got any less perfection than the ones that were covering more, because if you look at both of them, as long as a person, the bottom line is we've got to keep these rules in mind that the bottom line is, so maybe I have to retract what I said earlier, that if you don't keep as many, maybe you're not as perfected. No, I guess I can't say that, because really, if you are keeping a few, and this is taking up your time and you're approaching it properly, and your interest is really to see the perfection in these, you have to say that you are really living exactly as God wanted, and you can't do more than that. I mean, just another question you could ask. Well, I mean, if there were certain fundamentals that the Ben Noach didn't follow, then there would be harm. So really, you have to have a priority. You have to have a hierarchy in terms of what you're going to cover first. So this way, you know, ideas of God, what he is, what he's not, idolatry, all the most severe. And again, that's what the six or the seven Noahides are pointing to, you know, the fundamental categories. I mean, I follow that myself. You know, I have a magnetism towards the Talmudic tractate of Sanhedrin, because it talks about a lot of, you know, philosophical fundamentals. And you know, I could spend, you know, I've been spending so much time on the Ben Noach law. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, I've basically been living like a Ben Noach for the past couple of months, because I'm just basically studying those very areas that are the minimal obligations on the Ben Noach. But this is something which is the fundamental, so I have to know these equally. And if I just stayed on those, does that mean that I'm involved with a less perfected life? No, I mean, that has to be. These are the fundamentals. And there is only a certain amount of time that you have in your life to study, so you... I mean, again, fundamentals have to be first. But if a person, I think the barometer... To answer your question, Doug, the barometer in terms of is a Ben Noach missing anything by not taking on other ones, I would say no. I have to retract my first statement, because if he's really, you know, involved in his studies properly and with the right dedication and not wasting his time, so what more can he do? This is exactly what God wants. That, to me, that is perfection. A little bit long answer. Is it clear?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, we really have to, you know, keep our eyes also on, you know, before the Torah was given. What was man's perfection was using his intelligence and really using his time properly. I guess my initial answer is that I look at... Because even the, you know, a Jew can't keep all the mitzvahs. It's impossible. Some of them are relegated just to a priest or to the Levites. So even the whole system doesn't even apply to everybody. A person goes through his whole life and he doesn't eat bread, so he doesn't have to fulfill the command of saying the the blessing of the Birchas Hamazon. And of course, we have to eat bread certain times for holiday, but let's say, you know, other than that. Person's happily married, he never fulfills the command to give a divorce. So it's not where, you know, again, the fundamentals have to be learned. So if a Ben Noach is missing a fundamental, then for sure he's missing out. So that is very important, then, that we should really be cognizant of. That we should make sure to know the fundamentals, and if there's any of those that we did not address yet, then certainly right away we should jump on that. Okay, let me see if there's any question here on the line. Rivka in Seattle is writing, could the definition of evil be the justification of sin? That'd be part of it, Rivka. That'd be part of it. Also, she's writing, I'm thinking of the difference between stealing a loaf of bread and committing mass murder. I always thought one was wrong and the other is evil. Are both considered evil, or is there a difference between them? Well, at different levels of evil. I mean, evil, wrong here, we could use synonymously. Okay, those are your questions. All right, any questions from your end on this?
No, that explanation helped a lot. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Yeah, so it's important to have those... the knowledge of what the rabbi said about that, whether you learn a lot, whether you learn a little, as long as your intent is there, is proper, that's really the perfection. I mean, each day there's only so much you can do. You have to sleep 8 hours, it's time for eating, it's time for work. That time that we have for learning, So as long as that is dedicated to the pursuit of understanding, you know, clearly what God's will is in any given area that we're approaching. So that is all we can do. That is all that's, you know, in our power. That's why they said don't, you know, judge your perfection on the quantity. It has to be on the quality of your activity. But again, we do have to have the caveat that the correct notions of God have to be in place first. All right, maybe we'll talk about this more next week. It seems to be there's more to be discussed here than just what we touched on. All right, so maybe we'll wrap it up over here. And let's, you know, think of what we discussed and see if there's any questions. And if you have any, you know, write them down for sure, because I would like to flesh out if there's any other points that we didn't address so far, whether sin or the corruption of the intelligence, or, you know, the comparison between following a minimal amount of Ben Noach laws to more that you're not obligated on. Let's really examine this clearly so we're satisfied 100% with you know, the concept of God's justice here and punishment, reward, that we should really have that clear, all right? And I personally would like to really spend a little more time on this too.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thanks very much, Rabbi.
Okay. All right, so listen, have a good week. And again, anything comes up during the week, you know, pop an email or just jot down a note to make sure that we're not missing anything. Because sometimes, you know, you forget. It's a shame. I feel that way. If I had a question, I forgot the question, like, you know, it bothers me. So if anything comes up on the topic, you know, make sure that, you know, either send an email or write it down, and we make sure that we're covering it next week, all right?
Thank you.
Okay,
thank
you, everybody. Have a great week.
Thanks, you too. Pat Nishikawa, are you online?
What's that?
I'm trying to reach Pat Nishikawa.
Oh, okay. Okay, have a good day.
Thank you too.
Okay. All right, that ends today's session. I hope everybody enjoyed it. We'll try to continue next week, same time. Until then, have a very enjoyable week, and be well. Take care.